Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, leading you into the dark corners of the human mind once again to explore the unsolved disappearance of Ayla Reynolds, a 20-month-old child from Waterville, Maine, who vanished from her father's home after being put down to sleep at 8 p.m. on the night of December 16, 2011. When family members woke the next morning and discovered the little girl was gone, they called 911 for help, setting off what became the most extensive search ever conducted for a missing person in the state of Maine, and the third largest in the history of the U.S. Despite the effort, however, Ayla's whereabouts remain unknown, and the police assert she's dead. Now, Waterville is located along the I-95 corridor and has a population of approximately 16,600 residents. Like most places in small-town Maine, it's surrounded by ample forestry, bodies of water, and hiking trails, all of which is to say that it wouldn't be too difficult to find a place to conceal the body of a small child. Of course, it's also a town comprised of a population more likely to come from modest means, with the 2000 U.S. Census showing that nearly 20% of residents lived below the poverty line in terms of income, which is a rate nearly double that of the county in which it resides. And that's generally what we have in this case. Ayla's father, Justin DiPietro, lives in his mother's one-floor ranch-style home in town, which also has some type of finished basement that allows the occupants to sleep down there as well. Now, there's a neighboring house on one side of this structure, with perhaps no more than 10 feet separating the two homes. On the other side is a driveway that leads back to a small garage. To the right of that, we also have another home. So, if you're on the street, facing the home, you have a small front yard with one large tree partially obscuring the view of the home. Of course, this happens in December, so that tree would be bare and wouldn't offer much concealment. Behind the house is another larger home, and to the right of the driveway, like I said, sits yet another house. So, we have other homes located to the right, left, and rear of this one, all with windows facing Justin's house, and also within close proximity. The neighbors are not burdened with any trees blocking their view of the home in question. All of the entrances and exits from the house, including the windows, are in plain sight. The only obstruction I can see is the tree in the front yard that would partially block your view of the home from the street, but again, that would be mostly nullified by the fact it's stark in winter. So from the standpoint of an intruder wanting to enter the home, it's a risky proposition. You can enter from any side, whether by window or door, but in each case, you expose yourself to the direct possibility of being seen by a neighbor or a passing motorist. Now, inside the home on the night of December 16th, 2011, are Justin DiPietro, Ayla's father, who only gained custody of the little girl a couple of weeks prior, in addition to his sister, Alicia, who is accompanied by her son. Plus, Justin's girlfriend, Courtney, is also there with her own son. So we have a modest, one-floor home with multiple neighboring homes in very close proximity and a mostly unobstructed view from the street out front. There are five people in the home, aside from Ayla, on the night she disappears. Three of them, Justin, Alicia, and Courtney, are adults, while the remaining two are Alicia and Courtney's sons, who are children. In total, counting Ayla, we have six people going to bed on the night of December 16th inside this little home. And by morning, Ayla will have disappeared in the absence of anyone hearing a sound. Or so they say. Justin and his girlfriend Courtney, along with her son, were reportedly sleeping in the basement, while the remaining players were all located on the main floor. Ayla, according to witnesses, is sleeping alone in her own room at this time. Justin had put her to bed at 8 p.m., which is the last time he sees her, by his own account, but his sister Alicia checks on the little girl later that night. Some accounts have this happening as soon as 1 hour later, at 9 p.m., while others have it as late as 10 p.m., Regardless, that's the last time Ayla is reportedly seen in the home by a witness. So the narrative this suggests is that at some point between 10 p.m. on December 16th and 8:51 a.m. the next morning of the 17th, a span of approximately 11 hours, Ayla Reynolds was abducted from the home by an outside party whose identity and intentions remain unknown because they weren't witnessed perpetrating the crime. We have no ransom note or even anything similar to suggest the criminal desired anything beyond whatever Ayla herself offered by way of her presence. It leads us to believe, due to statistical probability, that she was most likely kidnapped by a pedophile for a sexual motive that would be covered up for the purpose of concealing his guilt and negating the possibility of being caught. So if that's the case, it means the perp entered the crowded home, managing to not stir anybody in the process, even Ayla, and also left once she was in his possession, again disturbing no one along the way. There's no sign of breaking and entering, and no evidence, either DNA or in terms of forensics, that suggests an outside party breached the home and took Ayla from her bedroom that night. Of course, what that's telling me is that, if they heard nothing related to an intruder, there wasn't anything to hear, because that person simply doesn't exist. As difficult as it would be to enter a small home with so many occupants in the absence of being heard, it would be exceptionally more difficult to exit in that manner. If you came in through a window alone and plan to leave with a child, you not only have to silence that child, but also exit the home the same way you came in, only this time burdened by a 30-pound human who isn't going to comply. She isn't 8 years old. You can't tell her to be quiet or you'll hurt her. At 20 months, her response is going to be to cry and wail if something goes wrong. Yet, we have no witness sightings of an intruder or even someone hearing either the victim or perpetrator. Combine that with the lack of DNA and no sign of forced entry, and it suggests that scenario very likely is not born of authenticity. I mean, you can't just say something happened and it magically did. The puzzle pieces have to fit. Unfortunately, this logic puts a square peg into a round hole. So what we need to do is craft a narrative conducive to what can be proven, or at the very least, one that's consistent with making this story as organic as possible. Now, how do we do that? Well, the truth doesn't have a permanent address, and can often be fleeting, even in the best of circumstances. But we have to do this. Follow the resources. We have to ask ourselves, who had the most to gain by it? Who was going to profit, either emotionally or from the standpoint of material wealth, or perhaps even both, by making Ayla Reynolds disappear? Let's go there. I want to address that before I talk about the evidence found inside the home, as I think it allows us greater context for viewing the truth about how this transpired. Ayla's father, Justin DiPietro, is unemployed at the time of the incident, which isn't exactly a crime by any stretch of the imagination, but definitely insinuates there might have been significant financial issues. Now, what really draws some red flags here is a set of coinciding circumstances that offer a twofold possibility. One thing that happens in the 2 weeks leading up to Ayla's disappearance is that Justin wins custody of the little girl from her mother, and the second thing is that he takes an insurance policy out on her life. Of course, that doesn't sound too suspicious, in and of itself, until you realize he has two young kids and only purchased a policy for Ayla, who just happens to vanish immediately afterward. In totality, Justin is unemployed, gets custody, buys an insurance policy, and within 2 weeks, Ayla is gone in a situation where she's never seen alive again. So, I ask you, do you believe the story about the intruder, who is just a phantom, someone who left no evidence or available motive in circumstances not even remotely conducive to discretion? Or do you think the prospect of a large cash payout enticed an unemployed, financially strapped young man with two kids to take the easy way out and try to collect on the misfortune of an innocent child? Now, consider this. Justin isn't taking an insurance policy out on himself in the case that he dies and other people, including his two children, will need financial assistance due to that. He's unemployed, and clearly in no position to shell out extra money for something like this, but he decides it's such a priority, he proceeds immediately after getting custody of Ayla. He needs a job to support her, not an insurance policy against her death. That's ridiculous. And why just her? He didn't have any reason to believe Ayla was more at risk to die than the other child at that time. So, life insurance policies are about securing the financial future of your loved ones in your absence. They aren't designed as a lottery ticket intended to pay out on the off chance your young, healthy daughter just happens to disappear one day. Life insurance policies protect against the volatility of life, against the harsh reality that we could be here and gone in a flash for any number of reasons, often leaving those in our care defenseless. It's about ensuring their future, not yours. But here we have a young man with no job lining up what amounts to the most unlikely payout in the form of his healthy daughter being abducted and never returning. If it wasn't intentional, it's a mind-boggling coincidence that he not only timed it perfectly, but also chose the correct daughter to whom he would apply the policy. That was a coin flip. Now, I could play that game, or I could just say, Justin clearly isn't a very bright guy. Of course, I'm choosing the latter here. I think he was desperate and chose to make a move. So why do I mention these things before we even examine the evidence inside? Well, if you're going to make someone disappear, an insurance payout in relation to the death is not necessarily imminent for the simple fact that one has to be declared dead in order for that to happen. And if the person just vanishes without a trace, in the case of a teen or adult, they very well could have just decided to run away, start a new life, etc. In the case of a child as young as Ayla, however, we'd have to assume her leaving would be the result of an abduction. For instance, your 20-month-old might walk out the door and wander off, even into the street or as far as the neighbor's house, but they don't have the capacity or resources to do any type of extensive traveling without assistance from adults. Or a dingo. I mean, if a dingo's got your baby, then yeah, totally understandable. But insurance companies aren't designed to accommodate ambiguity. So, she has to be proven dead, at least to an extent that she's declared dead in absentia. Otherwise, if you're the policyholder, it's possible you might never get paid. So what often happens in these situations is that a scenario unfolds suggesting there was foul play prior to the disappearance, specifically in the form of blood evidence. Significant bleeding in such a situation suggests bodily injury, and in conjunction with never returning, one has to assume the reason is that the human in question is deceased. This leads to an enormous amount of desperation on the part of the perpetrator because he's saddled with the responsibility to not only make the person disappear without being found, as that would reveal the true cause of death, but also to prove that the death, in fact, did occur. That's a tightrope that leaves very little margin for error and often leads to a familiar result of sociopathic comedy. Let's consider Josh Powell to get some context for this type of plan. He refused to work, and although there were times when he did, he was routinely fired for his arrogance, specifically for finding a way to tell every one of his bosses that he could do the job better than they could. So, Josh was a total failure on a professional level and relied on his wife Susan's dedication to her job to have an income. Obviously, Susan was reaching her breaking point and she was going to leave him due to his childish behavior. So, he took out an insurance policy on her life that would pay him a significant amount of money, and soon enough, she disappeared. But Susan wasn't found, and still hasn't been to this day. So the dilemma Josh had upon entering this narrative is that he had to craft a story in which she seemed to have died, but would never be recovered to prove how it happened. After examining the circumstances in that case, it was apparent to me that Josh didn't initially plan for Susan to disappear. Her disappearance was Plan B, not Plan A. After being served lunch by Josh, who absolutely never cooked for her, Susan became extremely sleepy and excused herself upstairs to bed, despite having a guest at the time. The guest left shortly thereafter, and Susan was never seen again. But what we know is that, at some point, she was back downstairs, on the living room couch, coughing and/or sneezing blood onto the couch and the floor next to it. In addition, there was a swipe mark of blood on the upper cushion at that same end of the couch. In totality, what it looked like is that Susan had been sitting on the couch and turned to cough or sneeze away from it, thereby putting her left hand against that cushion and leaving a bloody swipe mark. Basically, she had probably tried covering her mouth with a hand initially, and when doing so, realized she was sneezing or coughing blood, and thereby leaned over the edge of the couch to make it go on the floor instead. It's not something that happened during a struggle. It's clear she was incapacitated, at least to a certain extent, and had been placed on the couch. If she was coughing and sneezing blood, and with consideration for trying not to get it on the couch, it means she was bleeding within the context of a circumstance in which she didn't realize she was being attacked. Her primary focus is not fighting back or escaping. Rather, it's the retention of her furniture's integrity. She's simply trying to not cough or sneeze the blood on the couch. So, if she inexplicably became extremely tired a bit earlier in the day, to the point she literally couldn't maintain consciousness to host her guest, and then she's coughing or sneezing blood, rather than bleeding from any type of blunt force trauma, it's clear she was poisoned with a substance intended to shut down her respiratory system. Now, why would Josh poison her instead of making her disappear? Why did he want to create a situation where Susan died in the home? And the answer is because it means she's going to be found there. Josh fed her lunch, she passed out, and then he told her friend to leave as he was going to take the boys sledding with him. The intention was to make it seem as though she succumbed to suicide. Some insurance policies won't pay on that, but the one in question honored it. Most people believe Josh only intended to get rid of Susan, but they don't take into account his profound laziness. The last thing he wanted to do is work. So he avoided it by poisoning her in the house, hoping to come back from sledding with the kids to find her dead and report to the police that she just killed herself. But when he returned, she was still alive and very sick from being poisoned. His plan failed, so he had to get her out of the house. In the process, he leaves behind blood evidence. But Josh goes out of his way to clean up the blood because of one important factor. It's not going to look like an accident. She didn't fall down the stairs or hit her head on something. She ingested some type of poison intended to make her stop breathing. It's risky, but it proves one thing without any doubt. Susan's dead. If she simply disappears, proving she's dead could take years. Those are years in which Josh would have to work to support his kids and do it in the absence of Susan's income. So, he was looking for the fast track to getting paid and knew that her body being found in the home would very likely warrant such a result. It isn't a great plan, but it is one in which Josh's involvement can't be proven. If she ingests the food willingly, as she ultimately did, there won't be signs of a struggle. Unfortunately, like most experiments, they don't always turn out how you expect, and you're forced to move on to Plan B at the point you realize the logic is flawed. Josh's perfect scenario would be Susan being declared dead by suicide and having the insurance pay out on the claim as fast as possible in the aftermath because he doesn't want to work. But if his plan failed and she didn't die from the poisoning, he'd have no choice but to finish the job by killing her and disposing of the body to conceal the poisoning. So the end result is that he disposes of her in a place she'll never be found, or in a manner that makes recovery of remains impossible, because they'll offer us truth about the cause of death and lead to significant criminal liability in the matter. So, in cases where it's pretty clear a sociopath is trying to get paid, what you often get first is a very darkly comedic failure to competently walk that tightrope I mentioned. Instead, they lose their balance due to desperation and miscalculating the requirements of the task at hand, and are forced to accommodate a Plan B. The problem is that Plan B can't erase the mistakes of Plan A. It only hides them through disposal of the body, which negates comprehension of circumstance. I mean, we know Susan coughed or sneezed blood on the couch and floor after suddenly being incapacitated by extreme exhaustion, but we're unable to definitively connect those circumstances to a legitimate scenario by way of fact because we don't have a victim's body to corroborate the events that transpired. So, we have to speculate. And while that speculation doesn't lead down a path to proving anyone guilty, a la the Josh Powell case, what it does is exclude any possibility the person in question succumbed to the malice of an outside party. In terms of Ayla Reynolds, that's what we get as we go inside the house now. We're going to have a significant amount of blood evidence, none of which, in any way, is tied to the actions of an intruder hurting Ayla during the alleged abduction. We don't see process, meaning she wasn't knocked out or otherwise attacked to silence her for the purpose of making an escape without getting caught. There's going to be blood in various places, not concentrated in one area. The police will discover blood throughout the home, all of it belonging to Ayla. It's on the main floor and also down in the basement where her father was sleeping. It's not as though a 20-month-old is capable of fighting off an adult intruder in a scenario that turns the house into a bloodbath across multiple rooms and floors while absolutely nobody hears a sound. That's nothing short of ridiculous. So, in cases like these, where we have numerous areas of blood in various different places throughout the home, in which everybody claims to have been asleep when Ayla went missing, the real narrative is correlated to the blood trail. If her blood is there, her body was there, and if the blood moves, the body moves. For instance, at Josh Powell's house, we see the blood on the floor and couch, the result of a sneeze or cough, and also the swipe mark from someone's hand. It says Susan was in that spot and awake while bleeding from an injury or poisoning consistent with respiratory damage of some kind. We can't specifically say what was wrong with her, but we know this. Josh cleaned the couch. It's a fact. So he knew it happened, which tells us he was the person who caused Susan's death. Otherwise, there's no reason to cover it up. If you find her coughing blood on the couch, you call an ambulance. It's pretty simple. But that never happens. So, we know who the bad guy is, despite not knowing what transpired leading up to her death, or even where the body ended up. And the reason I mention is because we'll examine Ayla's case like that. Let's look at the blood evidence and ask ourselves what story that info tells us. It doesn't have to be perfect. Our narrative can be flawed in every way but one, which is the pursuit of proving the blood is not the result of outside interference. And as we do that, let's also remain cognizant of how that blood, just like the Powell case, suggests a transition from Plan A to Plan B due to failure of logic. I mean, staging a crime scene, especially in the context of murder, lends itself to a host of unforeseen complications for which the sociopath can't prepare due to a couple of reasons. One is that they became obsessed with the end result of acquiring the resources in question to the detriment of their thought process and planning. And the other is the experiential factor. Most things don't require killing, and therefore, very few of us have experience accommodating a perfect murder. It's a ridiculous concept in practice, no matter how sexy it looks on paper. in a thriller novel, it might keep you on the edge of your seat. But in the real world, trying to avoid detection through forensics, DNA, witnesses, etc., is very difficult. Most of us have a conscience, of course, and wouldn't do something like this. And for those of us who would, the threat of being imprisoned is normally enough incentive to thwart those desires to proceed. Unfortunately, the sociopath can only see the resources at the end of the rainbow and not the folly in trying to obtain them through risky and often illogical means. But that's what they do. Very simply put, the sociopath does not give a fuck about utilizing sound logic. Not ever. It's Justin Ross Harris leaving his son in a hot car for 8 hours and expecting to be believed it was just an accident. It's Casey Anthony walking the cops around Universal Studios to her office that didn't exist and the job she hadn't worked in almost 3 years. It's Michael Peterson beating his wife over the head with a fireplace poker, leaving multiple impressions of the instrument on her head and blood spatter from the strike shooting up the inner legs of his shorts, while suggesting she just fell down the stairs, only for us to learn it wasn't even the first woman to whom he did this. He even hung the same painting at the bottom of the stairs for the second death that was at the bottom of the stairs for the first one. It's O.J. Simpson saying he cut his hand on broken glass in his Chicago hotel room right after we learn his wife and lover were butchered with a knife. The fallout from poor logic requires lies that don't properly correlate to evidence. So, if that's the case with Justin DiPietro and the disappearance of Ayla Reynolds, we should find that the blood evidence inside the home causes that predicament. Now, just to clear something up first, you might be wondering why Justin was given custody of Ayla in a situation where he was unemployed. It turns out her mom, Trista, went to rehab for alcohol, leading the Department of Health and Human Services to put Ayla in Justin's care. Trista says she contacted social workers several times about her husband's poor behavior, which alleges abuse, including Ayla ending up with a black eye, bruises, and a soft cast on her arm. Now, let's go into Ayla's bedroom first. Police say blood was found on the face of one of her dolls and also on her pink slippers. It's a small amount that isn't necessarily indicative of a traumatic injury. There's also no blood found in her crib or in the surrounding area on the floor. Down in the basement, where her father slept the night of her disappearance, we have blood inside the tongue of one of his shoes and also on the electrical cord leading from a fan. The blood on both of these items is described as drops. So, then we have a plastic container, also in the basement, which is blue, that not only has blood on the outside of it, but also on a bedsheet stuffed inside it. Again, it's all Ayla's blood. Now, all of this sounds pretty innocent, in the sense that we don't have large quantities of blood, or evidence that the blood was a result of blunt force trauma. But here's where it gets creepy. A bloodstain, approximately the size of a fist, and one which contains evidence of other biological matter consistent with Ayla's presence, is found on Justin's mattress. In addition, blood spatter is found on a wall in the basement, and the same is found on the floor. There's also a wooden pallet leaning against one wall down there, which proves to have blood spatter on it as well. The last place blood is discovered is in Justin's vehicle, specifically on a car seat. So this is a significant collection of blood evidence, but it would be fair to say that small children are incredibly vulnerable to recklessness that leads to bodily injury. I mean, I'd guess I cut myself at least 10 times more often as a child than I do now, the reason being that the experiential factor allows you to be more careful. So, what does Ayla's family have to say about why the blood would be present as a result of natural circumstances rather than foul play? They contend Ayla had lactose issues, which led to her vomiting on a regular basis. Due to the forceful nature of this activity, it's possible she caused minor damage to soft tissue that sometimes led to a small amount of blood being present in her vomit. This is apparently not a common symptom of lactose issues, but nonetheless, it happens. Though, we're talking about a very small amount of blood resulting from the lactose issue, if indeed it is legitimate. Ayla certainly didn't cough up a fist-sized spot of blood on her father's mattress. So, what does all of this evidence tell us? According to police, this isn't a small amount of blood consistent with the suggestion of a lactose problem. It's enough blood for them to believe everybody in the house that night, specifically the adults, knows more than they'll admit. But in totality, just by way of a cursory examination of the numerous places in which blood is found, and the fact the adults heard nothing, it says this crime was very likely not the result of an intruder entering the house during the night and taking Ayla. Occam's razor suggests something more akin to the presence of an inside job. But who in the world would hurt Ayla? The most likely answer is Justin DiPietro. He took out the insurance policy on her life, and 2 weeks later, she disappears. It should be obvious. But then, we have to wonder what role the other occupants in the house that night played in this mess. I mean, why would they comply? Well, it isn't too difficult for me to see that this guy is an abuser who manipulates women. Just listen to the reaction of Ayla's mother, Trista, who is Justin's ex. Try to put yourself in her shoes. Your daughter is residing in the home of her abusive father, who just purchased a life insurance policy in her name right before she disappears. A normal reaction to that is to be incredibly suspicious of Justin, even accusatory. It's entirely clear he's lying, and the police have explicitly told you that. Now, I would give him a mouthful and turn the heat way up on this dude. But listen to Trista's comments after the abduction, when she's already told her ex is lying. She says, "I was wanting to maybe lash out a little bit about it, but," and I'll stop the quote there. So, as soon as you hear the "but" part of a statement like that from someone who has suffered abuse at the hands of another, you know for certain that she's about to justify his poor behavior, even though it is absolutely not warranted. That's what people do to defend their abusers, even if it's an ex. They offer the benefit of the doubt when there is no doubt, because they've always lived in that cycle of trying to please the person. So, she says she wanted to be mad, yet the rest of her sentence goes, quote, "But that wasn't going to get me anywhere. It was amazing to have him by my side yesterday, to support Ayla as her parents, as mom and dad." She even highlights the word "amazing" with a bit of overexpression to make it seem so. But it's not. Any rational person would be able to see Justin DiPietro was involved. I mean, there's blood spatter all over the basement, and she's like, "I'm glad he was there to support Ayla." As though the fact they couldn't remain a couple in life was at least emotionally reconciled through their mutual support. And I'm over here like, insurance policy, blood spatter, no evidence of an intruder. This guy does not deserve the benefit of the doubt. But he gets it. So what we can ascertain from that is the reality that he has the same emotional influence, if not stronger, over the current girlfriend who was with him in the home, specifically the basement, on the night Ayla disappeared. So if you're wondering why there's blood spatter all over the place in a room where a woman slept with Justin, but she's not blaming him in any way, there's your answer. I think emotional abuse plays a significant role in the mystery present in this case. And if we consider those injuries Ayla allegedly suffered as a result of abuse, from the black eye to the soft cast on her arm, we realize that emotional abuse is backed by the threat of violence. Of course, it's very difficult to emotionally manipulate a 20-month-old. And that's the reason we often see men who emotionally abuse adult women resort to physical measures with children. If you hurt a child, you can send a very clear message. They understand physical pain. But any attempt to emotionally control a 20-month-old is going to be a failure. Anyhow, police search intensively for any sign of Ayla, with the total number of law enforcement participating quickly reaching 75 people, who all came up empty. So the police publicly take the stance that they believe the three adults present in the house on the night of Ayla's disappearance know more than they're telling. And of course, as the reality sets in, Trista will come to realize the truth about Justin. She'll go from being by his side in support to standing next to him in court. Yet, these things I'm saying are speculative, right? I mean, how sure am I that Justin is an abuser and that it affected his girlfriend Courtney's judgment in the same way that it did for his ex Trista? Well, my answer is 100% sure. And since he is an abuser, it shouldn't be hard to prove that Courtney is the next victim. And bingo, there it is. A couple of years later, Justin gets arrested and charged for physically assaulting Courtney in public. They ultimately break up, as she clearly comes to the realization he's a bad guy, just like Trista did. But really, it's too late. If she knows more and has withheld information about the night in question, then it's also likely she participated in a manner that would leave her liable to an extent she fears making a deal with prosecutors might not even be feasible. I don't know if she contacted a lawyer regarding the possibility of such a thing, but if there was an insurance policy involved, it's reasonable to suggest she might have been promised some of that money for going along with the plan. So, the police call this a criminal investigation. They don't believe an accident took place, whether Ayla wandered out of the home or something similar happened. They clearly believe foul play was involved, and again, that the adults know more. I'm on board with that. But as opposed to their ignorance regarding what really transpired within the walls of the home, I think I have a strong understanding. That's why I set this up with the discussion about the plan Josh Powell conducted. Here's what I think went down that fateful night. The best way to proceed with this plan for Justin, if he wants to not only be perceived as innocent in Ayla's death, but also play within the rules of the insurance payout, is to stage an accident in which he would have the least liability. So for instance, he can't get out of his car, come inside from the cold December weather, and suddenly realize 8 hours later that he left his baby in the car seat. That's what put Ross Harris in prison for life. At the very least, even if it's a result of forgetfulness, there's a degree of neglect that extends into the spectrum of criminality. So what Justin DiPietro needs to do is create a circumstance in which an accident occurs that renders the following logic when reverse engineered. He wants accidental death precipitated by a circumstance Ayla created in her youthful ignorance. So, in the same way you might leave your car keys hanging on a rack up high, and your toddler stands on a chair to grab them before sticking them into an electrical socket, Justin needs a scenario in which Ayla succumbed to tragedy. He needs her to be found dead in a manner that says the accident happened despite the fact that he did the right thing to prevent it. A closer fit to what we're actually talking about would be the possibility that she fell out of her crib, hit her head, and ultimately died from injuries sustained during the tumble, whether it's bleeding on the brain, a broken neck, or even asphyxiation. Think of what likely happened to Madeline McCann. The evidence suggests she was the victim of an accidental fall, but one that was precipitated by her parents sedating her prior to going out to dinner. Due to their resulting liability, they had to cover up the death. Now, that means we need to look at it from Justin's perspective. Ayla is alone in her bedroom during the night. So once she's checked on for the last time, between 9 and 10 p.m., by Justin's sister Alicia, Justin won't be expected to have entered her room until the next morning. He has the benefit of being located in the basement, which allows him the luxury of distancing himself from any noises related to the fictional abduction about to take place. So what we need to do is identify the equivalent of that in terms of an accident. What I mean is that the accident has to be a circumstance for which Justin could reasonably not be held accountable to knowing it took place due to his lack of proximity, limiting his sensory awareness of the situation. So to accomplish that, and also limit his liability, he needs Ayla to appear as though she took proactive steps to escape the measures that the parents put in place to prevent accidents. Now, Ayla's sleeping in a crib, and she's 20 months old. By this time, she's more like a small child and a little bit less of a baby. Justin describes her as an infant in his 911 call, but at 20 months, she's not. This isn't a little helpless baby. At 20 months, kids are trying to make all sorts of power moves. They're like wind-up toys. You just see them take off. Sometimes it's into the street. Other times they climb on things, and so on. But at that age, heading toward the time known as the Terrible Twos, they're indulging a previously unknown level of physical coordination. And that means they're going to get hurt. I mean, we see the tragedy of the Madeleine McCann case. She was 3. Small kids do adventurous things to accommodate normal adult activities. So, it's speculated that all Madeleine was trying to do when she climbed the couch and fell off the back onto the floor is to look out the window and see if she could spot her parents. By that same token, in this case, a likely scenario would be that Ayla, at 20 months, isn't just lying on her back, crying, and waving her arms in the crib. An infant really has no concept of the support bars on the side of the crib. They don't mean anything. But once the child grows larger, more physically capable, and curious, those bars and the resulting space in which they're confined to the crib essentially become a prison. And if you're in prison and can see freedom through the bars, what do? You try to get out. I mean, let's get real. For every one time a car seat saves a child's life, there are countless occasions when the straps holding them in serve the more practical purpose of keeping them from climbing out of it on their own. For every time a kid gets hit by a car while wearing a bike helmet, there's a plethora of incidents where the danger and resulting accident were caused by the child, such as jumping off a ramp, doing a wheelie, riding too fast downhill, losing control, etc. So, that's what we need to satisfy the circumstances at hand. An accident caused by Ayla's ignorance resulting in tragic death that couldn't have been prevented even though her father was still present in the home at the time. He needs to appear responsible. For me, falling headfirst onto the floor after climbing out of the crib is the most likely manner in which Justin could satisfy all of the requirements. If he's in the basement, he probably can't hear the sound while sleeping. If Ayla is rendered unconscious by the fall, then her cries for help are non-existent and therefore can't be heard by anyone. If the injuries from the fall cause a severe concussion, broken neck, or anything similar, she isn't going to survive until morning. In that circumstance, Justin incurs the least amount of liability. He put her in her crib, had a family member check on her before bed, and found her in the morning, at which point, it was too late. I have no doubt that's the intention. That's what gets him paid the fastest. If he isn't liable, she's declared dead immediately, and the scene offers what looks to be an accident. So, again, he gets paid. I mean, this isn't something you do for your future, like a 401k, an IRA, or an investment account. It's not about delayed gratification or planning a future. If you fight for custody, immediately buy a life insurance policy for a child, and she disappears days later under bizarre conditions. You're a sociopath who can't resist. Even the cops know it. They explicitly say that Justin DiPietro knows more. So what I think he intended was to stage such an accident. Basically, he would go into Ayla's room while she was asleep or when he was taking her to bed and manipulate a situation that left the appearance of an accident. Now, I don't have pictures of her crib or the bedroom, so I can't speculate with any degree of specificity. But here are his options. He can asphyxiate her in some way and then place the body according to how that would transpire physically during an accident. For instance, if she climbed over the top of the crib and fell, she could land head first, snapping her neck, or even just losing consciousness in a manner where she suffocated. Or she could land on something else, become contorted in some manner, and, again, no longer be able to breathe. But no matter what, it has to appear as though she escaped the crib of her own volition, leading to an accident. For me, the most probable scenario is that he attempted to stage the scene by dropping her directly on her head next to the crib, hoping it would cause enough damage that she'd be dead by morning, which would be consistent, obviously, with an accident. There are any number of ways to stage something like this, as you might imagine, so I won't run down a list of methods for killing small children. It's a little morbid. But what we can see, even without addressing further possibilities, in terms of the specificity of the staged accident, is that this isn't a very good plan. Children who die in this manner generally do so as a result of freak accidents. They die under circumstances where thousands of other kids, if not millions, just like them, who did the same thing, survive. Sometimes without injury, and simply by way of luck. I mean, we all ran into the street as little kids, despite moving traffic and our parents' wishes, but most of us survived. It's only on occasion that someone gets hit by the car and dies. So, death is the exception in these cases of youthful ignorance, and not the rule. The reason is that humans are exceptionally resilient. In order to die under such circumstances, the odds really have to be against you. Yes, I knew a few kids growing up who died in stupid freak accidents. But for each of them, I knew of thousands of others who never even came close to dying from the same circumstances. I got hit by a car twice as a kid. I had a friend who put his mom's keys in the electrical socket. I watched another friend come close to drowning. But none of these things came to fruition. That's how it usually goes. But when you're a sociopath, like a Josh Powell or a Justin DiPietro, you convince yourself the opposite is true and do it out of desperation. You have that rigid logic that only conforms to your desires rather than good sense. Because the fact of the matter is that, regardless of what Justin does to make it seem like Ayla died accidentally, he's likely going to fail. The odds are against him. It's that simple. So if he drops her on her head, or even anything similar, guess what? If that doesn't work, you can't repeat the action. It has to be perfect on the first try. If you're trying to stage an accident involving a death, you generally get one shot to make it appear authentic, as it pertains to the damage inflicted on the person. If Justin drops her on her head twice, it's beyond obvious what truly happened. So just like with Josh Powell hoping the poisoning is going to work to make his wife die under circumstances that seem to be suicide, meaning of her own volition, Justin does the same in his attempt to kill his daughter. But it doesn't work. And just like with Josh, that leaves you in a position where you have to inflict the death manually, leaving no question as to the perpetrator's identity. The only way to remedy that in the aftermath is to dispose of the body in a manner in which it's either never found, or you literally make it disappear through disposal methods like chopping it up and dissolving it in a vat of acid next time you're chilling at Jeffrey Dahmer's place. That's what Josh Powell had to do. One way or another, Susan couldn't be found because he'd clearly poisoned her, evidenced by her passing out and coughing up blood. He intended for her to die peacefully in her sleep in the bedroom, and instead, he ends up with blood evidence in other parts of the house because the failure requires moving her afterward while she's physically damaged. I envisioned the same thing with Justin DiPietro trying to accommodate his plight with Ayla. He sets up this staged accident with a definitive action equivalent to Josh poisoning Susan, which, for a toddler in a crib, would be climbing out of it, resulting in an unforeseen fall leading to death. But the sociopath can't see past his faulty logic and soon learns he miscalculated to an extent he's failed. I mean, the sociopath is generally a know-it-all. Go back to what I said about Josh always telling his bosses that he knew better than they did. It was clearly incorrect, but he believed his logic was superior to theirs. So, anyway, we find a very small amount of blood in Ayla's bedroom, a bit on her doll's face, and another small amount on her pink slippers. So it's possible the insinuation Justin was looking to create through a fall out of the crib is that Ayla might have been going to get her doll. That was her impetus for climbing out, seeing the doll, but being unable to reach it. If there's blood on the doll and none in the crib, then we know whatever happened in terms of the physical damage causing the bleeding, regardless of the truth, happened outside of the crib. Plus, we have no evidence to suggest an intruder was in the house. So whatever happened to Ayla in her bedroom took place outside of the crib and also caused very little bleeding, but she did lose a bit of blood. There's no sign of an attack here. In fact, it appears as though an assault on her took place in the basement. But Ayla's bedroom shows no signs of that. There's no blood spatter. So, picture her being dropped on her head and ask yourself, is that something that would, more often than not, lend itself to a broken neck or concussion along with a bit of bleeding? Or would it have her gushing blood all over the place? The answer, of course, is that a blunt force impact against a flat floor on your head is less consistent with a scenario involving excessive bleeding and more akin to making you lose consciousness. So, whatever happened to Ayla in this room caused very minimal bleeding and failed. That's how we get down to the basement, which really breaks my heart in this case. It's pretty obvious what happened next due to the failure of the staged accident. At this point, Justin needs to get rid of the body and also needs to ensure she's dead. Otherwise, he's in a lot of trouble. So he takes her down to the basement. Let's review the blood evidence there to understand how this might have transpired. As opposed to Ayla's bedroom, we have something down here called blood spatter. Blood spatter, of course, indicates an impact of some kind. Now, we don't have access to the specifics of this blood spatter, meaning its trajectory, but the locations in which it's found definitely form a coherent narrative consistent with what I'm suggesting happened. It's at this point Justin, whose staged accident failed, needs to finish her off. And how he does it tells us where Ayla went. So, if we have blood spatter on the basement floor, and at least one wall down there, and it's also on a pallet leaning up against the wall, we can safely assume Ayla was hit with something while she was on the floor. But this is problematic. Why create a bloodbath when all you really need to do is put a plastic bag over her face? I mean, this isn't a 250-pound man who stands over 6 feet tall. You don't have to beat a small child with a baseball bat to get her to succumb. She can't offer much resistance. But he chooses the least conservative method anyway. I mean, why the hell would you want to get blood all over the place when you could just use something to smother her? Well, just like Josh Powell, he knows that if the body is found in the state in which the person truly died, foul play directly connected to him is going to arise during autopsy if and when the remains are found. So, just like Josh then took the effort to make Susan disappear entirely, to negate his liability, Justin is saddled with the same responsibility. Josh was confident that dropping Susan down a mine would render a result in which she would remain missing forever. It's not a foolproof strategy, but it is a reasonable assumption based upon the number of mines in the region in which they lived. So, for Justin, he's in Waterville, Maine, which, not surprisingly, is known for ample bodies of water, perhaps nearly a dozen within the town limits alone, and a ridiculous number of other lakes and streams throughout the state elsewhere. Combined with a sparse population and plenty of forestry, Maine is a pretty good place to scatter a body. The fish eat a part here, the bears eat another part there. You get the idea. Now, the important part of it, for Justin, is that whatever action he takes, meaning however he chooses to assault Ayla physically to cause death, that action must negate the appearance of the injury caused by the failed attempt to make it seem like an accident. So if he looks at the body and thinks, shit, they're going to know what I did, then his best move is to destroy the body and get rid of the remains, knowing that the initial injury caused by the failed accident is no longer detectable. So, a natural place to make a mess in the basement is on the floor. But the floor being so hard causes two problems. One is excessive blood spatter, as striking Ayla with an object creates a collision between the object and the floor, with her body sandwiched in between. The pressure of impacts leads to blood spatter, and with a hard surface beneath, not only do you get the spatter, but the strikes are going to cause a lot of unnecessary noise. So, if you wanted to soften the surface beneath her body while hitting her, in order to reduce the blood spatter and loud noise, getting as close as possible to eliminating those things, where would you put her? That's right, on the bed. And guess what we find on the mattress? A blood spot the size of a fist. One that contains other biological matter. Let me see. What could have caused that? It's called the back of Ayla's head. I believe he put her on the floor, started hitting her with something, and soon after realized his folly, in the same way he was ignorant that the staged accident wouldn't work. So, still being an ignorant fool, he puts her on the bed to soften the noise and reduce the spatter. He hits her repeatedly and quickly, believing he can cause the necessary damage and get her off the sheets before the blood soaks through them onto the mattress. But he miscalculates again, because hitting the front side of her body on the floor is causing damage to the back of her head that he can't see happening. So he puts her on the bed, knowing he can now hit her with much more force, causing less spatter and noise, but the trade-off is that the increased force causes physical damage to her head so severe that he can't get her off the bed again before blood and other biological matter, such as flesh and or hair, soak through the mattress. I mean, we have to remember he's panicking. This isn't plan A. This is plan B, a method of last resort. And just like Josh Powell, he fails to succeed, in the sense that people are now going to know what he did, even if it can't be proven. Josh got caught trying to clean and dry the couch where they found Susan's blood. He refused to acknowledge the reality that Susan never bled on it. Meanwhile, Justin DiPietro, when shown a photo of blood evidence at the police station, allegedly gets up from his seat and runs out of the building. I'm not joking. Of course, he took a polygraph test and then denied that the police offered him the results of it. Conversely, the cops say he's well aware of the result. And while that result isn't public, I think the assertion by police that Justin knows more than he's telling pretty much gives us a great idea what transpired during that test. He didn't seem to tell the truth. So, the most significant bleeding, to our knowledge, took place on Justin's bed. So, what I want to point out now is the segue from the floor to the bed. How do we know this happened? Well, remember the plastic tote on the floor I mentioned? That container? The one with a drop of blood on it? And also the sheet inside, which also has blood on it? Now, how would you suggest that got there? Here's what I think. I believe the sheets were removed from Justin's bed so that he could hit Ayla while she was lying on it, for the reasons I mentioned, and when doing so, after having already hit her and caused her to bleed on the floor, he took his own hands, with blood on them, and retrieved unused sheets from the tote, accidentally leaving drops of blood not only on another sheet in the tote, but also on the outside of the tote as well. He then puts those new sheets from the tote on the bed and places Ayla on top. At this point, she's only bleeding to an extent he still believes the sheets will be sufficient to keep her blood from soaking through onto the mattress. But when he goes to finish the job, meaning inflicting the kill shot or shots, the force utilized causes enough damage to her head that she bleeds profusely above and beyond what he expected. He quickly removes her and the sheets from that spot, most likely wrapping her in them, and so we only end up with a fist-sized spot of blood on the mattress consistent with the circumference of the back of this child's head, because that's where he was inflicting the most forceful damage intended to kill her. Of course, the skull is going to lend itself to creating the most noise and blood spatter because it doesn't give way unless crushed. Undoubtedly, hitting that skull caused a lot of noise and spatter, which made him realize hitting it harder to crush it and inflict the kill shot was going to be very loud and messy. So he takes the sheets off the bed, gets new ones, puts her on top of them on the bed, and crushes her skull with the object. She bleeds profusely and immediately, meaning he doesn't get her off the bed until that circle of blood and biological matter has soaked through the sheets. And I hate to say it like this, because it sounds arrogant, but we know I'm correct just by default of one thing. When the cops show up, the bed has clean sheets on it, but there's that fist-sized spot of blood underneath them. There isn't any way in hell that Ayla could bleed that much on her father's mattress without him knowing about the incident. And if the wound was inflicted that night that she disappeared, meaning by an intruder, in a situation where Justin couldn't have known it happened, we're presented with an impossibility because he claimed to have been sleeping in that bed all night. So unless the intruder removed Justin and his girlfriend from the bed without waking the couple, and subsequently killed Ayla without disturbing their sleep, Justin is lying, and so is his girlfriend Courtney. Ayla Reynolds was killed in that basement. Blood evidence creates a narrative. For lack of a better explanation, this is forensic psychology trying to tell us the truth. There is a very specific reason that blood comes out of the body red and leaves the worst stains. It has a lot to do with detection and creating technology. You can walk into a crime scene and deduce what happened by analyzing the blood. Nature can't open its mouth and say, ooh, I know who done it, he's the killer. It communicates with us intuitively, like your dog waiting by the door to go out. Now, your dog won't lie. If he's at the door, you better believe there's no deception at play. If you open it, he's going out. But humans lie and manipulate, so we need to be held responsible for our actions. Yet, nature is what provides accountability on that matter. If someone redirects light to conceal truth, nature attempts to render a physical imprint that will intuitively make others question the narrative. If you steal money at the company where you work, the numbers on somebody's computer screen are ultimately going to suggest something is wrong. Likewise, if you punch a classmate in the face and deny it but the person has a broken nose, nature can tell authority figures, by way of intuition, that you're not being honest. If the principal sees the broken nose, then clearly there was a punch that led to it. All of this leads to the inception of better technology intended to ultimately extract intuition entirely in favor of utilizing the more reliable properties of data. So yes, blood spatter evidence is wonderful, but technology that can literally read DNA and qualify something as belonging to a specific person is superior. That's what nature wants out of the deal. We use its intuition to cultivate greater understanding of the truth that leads to the formation of technology that is superior by way of data and specific to humanity. Data excludes nature's participation. Slowly but surely, we're eradicating its presence and simultaneously, by default of that action, also surrendering our humanity to AI. So, to summarize, I think Justin purchased an insurance policy on Ayla's life upon gaining custody of her in order to stage an accident in which she would definitely be found dead in the absence of his liability, specifically a fall from her crib. In practice, I believe this effort failed, and he was forced to go to Plan B, which was to kill her, dispose of the body, and suggest she was abducted as a means of still being able to collect on the policy due to her death. In the process, he took her from the failed accident in her bedroom, on the main floor, down to the basement. She was placed on top of something on the floor, most likely a sheet, at which point he beat her with a blunt object that caused blood spatter to hit the floor and at least one wall, in addition to a pallet leaning against a wall. Due to the unforeseen blood spatter leaving physical evidence, Justin went to the plastic container, or tote, containing additional sheets and/or blankets, and while removing things from it for use on the bed, he not only left a spot of blood on one of the sheets that remained inside, but also left a drop on the outside of the container. The regular sheets that were on the bed at the time were removed, and the new ones were placed on top of the bare mattress. At this point, having softened the surface to reduce the noise and blood spatter, Justin unloads on Ayla's head, causing massive physical damage leading to excessive bleeding that leaves blood and other biological matter on the bed in the spot where the back of her head is located. He then wraps her up in the sheets underneath her, or if it's a blanket, and removes her from the bed, only then realizing the blood has already soaked through onto the mattress, which can't be corrected. So when it dries, he simply puts the original sheets back on the bed, thereby covering the bloodstain from being in plain view. He specifically targets the head, rather than suffocating her, due to the fact he needs to negate the appearance of the staged accident that failed. If he dropped her on her head and wants to cover it up, the best way is to crush the head itself. Is it possible he cut the body into pieces? Sure, but I'm not seeing that as probable. What I see is that he delivered a severe beating to the head that caused enough bleeding to make the potential for extracting all blood evidence from the scene impossible. So, if that happened in the home, where was she taken for disposal? Well, it's winter in Maine, so burying her in the earth would be dreadfully difficult, if not impossible, without machinery. A shovel isn't going to cut it. So dumping her somewhere in water makes a whole lot more sense. Now, with so many local waterways, and even that many more located throughout the state, it would be a cumbersome task to find her, even if the search party was the largest ever in the state's history. On that note, of course, they don't find her, and it's neither surprising nor the result of a lack of effort. It's just that a small body can get lost in a haystack pretty easily, and if you're surrounded by woods and water, you might never find her. Accordingly, nearly 8 years after the crime, nobody has any idea where Ayla is. Except the person who killed her and the others who were present that night. And that person was the hopeless, broke, unemployed Justin DiPietro, who had two young children with two different mothers and was still living in his own mom's basement, with no prospects to escape that shitty reality. He wanted out of there, out of that life. And like Josh Powell, the reason he resorted to sociopathy, and by extension, crime, including the potential for an insurance payout that would solve all his problems, is because he refused to act like a man. He didn't want to do the work. And at the bottom of that barrel is a daunting truth that we all face. Change is hard. The sociopath merely inverts the values necessary to succeed in society. Instead of emotionally using your daughter as the reason to improve your life, you engage the physical manifestation of the emotional issue and literally use her body as a way to solve the problem by getting paid on an insurance policy and helping yourself. What's extracted from the equation by taking this route is a character arc. Justin's bank account would change, but his character wouldn't improve in the process. Evolution makes that a very low percentage play for a reason. The only way to win that one is to use technological methods superior to those currently in existence. He was incapable of such innovation, as most of us are, and so he failed in his plight. And given the level of ineptitude and ignorance on display at the crime scene, I truly believe there's a good possibility Ayla's remains could be recovered one day. Justice might be served. In the meantime, I ask myself what this case says about existence, about the way we choose to live in the short time we have on Earth, and the result of choices that Justin DiPietro made. I think back to a night years ago at my apartment in Philly that I shared with three roommates. It was in a high-rise off Ben Franklin Parkway, right at the edge of Center City in what's considered the art museum area. It was a four-bedroom place, and I had the smallest room in the back, one that was connected to the master bedroom by way of a small door that suggested my room was for a baby or a small child who needed to be checked on by their parents in the next room. And it was appropriate. Things weren't going well for me at the time. I was barely getting by, really unhappy, unemployed, and not doing much to change things. My roommates were far better off, both in terms of their accomplishments, paychecks, social lives, and so on. I was struggling, and couldn't seem to find my way. But something in me wouldn't quit. I believed there was a way out of it. And my brain kept saying to me, "You have to start writing. That's who you are." I'd been told I was a writer by every teacher or professor whoever gave me an assignment of any kind. They just knew it, and I knew it too. But I couldn't bring myself to write. For some reason, I was frozen, and had been since I was a kid. I heard of all these stories about writers of all types growing up and writing endlessly along the way. That wasn't me. I always knew I had the talent, but I couldn't see that I had value. I felt worthless, stifled, unable to get past those feelings to become who I really was. I would dream about it and use the resulting emotions to cope the best I could. But as the years passed, the return on that method dwindled, along with my hope. I started to feel as though I was going to give up. Not just on my dreams, but in life itself. I was at the end of my rope. There was only one choice. Writing. So I started thinking about this stage play, and somehow I was inspired to start. I didn't question it. I just began writing. Yet, what's common to most writers, especially those who are inexperienced, is that the way the story appears in your head, in a state of perfection, both in terms of its composition and the resulting emotional resonance experienced by the audience, turns out to be a big fat lie. What you really get is this terribly flawed, awkward first draft that is something far less than you imagined. It's a rough sketch of your ideas, a first draft that will require numerous rewrites to improve. And even then, it will never be perfect. It's the equivalent of the human condition. But when you're at rock bottom, sometimes all you have in the gas tank is enough energy to make one good attempt at climbing out of the hole. It's a Hail Mary. Often you don't have the energy or even the strength to keep trying. And so, I wrote that entire first draft of the play in one night and found myself drinking coffee while typing like a madman until maybe 4 a.m. When I finished, I was high as a kite emotionally, sure that this courageous act was going to compel me to the place where I'd become happy. And that's when I started reading the play to indulge my inflated ego just a bit. Sadly, I was crushed to learn it was all a lie that I told myself because I was lost. The play was terrible, and I felt like a fool for trying. I was angry at myself and going through all my memories to curse every person who ever told me that I was talented. There was never a lower moment in my life. I didn't know what to do. It hurt. So I just sat there, and I could feel the emotion welling up inside me. I was going to break down, and it wasn't going to be 10 minutes. It was going to be forever. I put my hands in my face and just started crying. I sat there on the edge of my bed, believing that the world was a cruel place where the sun would never shine. There was this enormous dark storm cloud looming over my existence. And suddenly I had this thought, a very strange one I'd never had before. My brain told me not to quit. Yet, this time, it wasn't because I had a feeling I could still succeed. My mind was urging me to go on because something I say in my writing might make a difference in someone else's life. If I was here, feeling hopeless and alone, then there are certainly others experiencing the same thing. And if that's so, maybe there's something I can say to make the sun peek through the clouds for them, even if there's nothing I can do for myself. So I wrote another play, and did it with the brutal honesty and craziness that only I can do. I gave them me, and nothing more, for better or worse. And it worked. Soon after, I learned I won a competition, and they produced my play. It ran for a couple of months, 5 nights per week, and was reviewed well in many places. I got excited about my writing again, and went full speed at it. But for some reason, despite the fact I was writing well, things weren't working out as I had planned. And what happened is that once I had that small success under the pretense of bringing hope to others, I began to think only about what was going to happen for me. I wanted to know what I could get, from jobs to friends to awards and more. I cared about myself. So I failed. Not once or twice. So many times I can't even begin to count. And the way I tried to remedy that was to rewrite. Not my life, just the pages. I thought, I just need to work harder at rewriting these scripts, and everything will be fine. But it was just a lie. The worst lies we offer are always the ones we tell ourselves. It's really painful. So I had to stop. I quit writing and asked myself what I really needed to succeed. Strangely, my brain was still telling me to rewrite. But whereas I'd been so ignorant in the past to believe the script was what needed to be rewritten, I then realized I was still trying to find success, peddling the first draft of my life. The world wasn't looking for that, though. Like any audience, for any story ever written, they simply wanted to know one thing. What happens next? Change. I had to give the world the next draft of Ryan Krause. There was nowhere to hide from that. But I was scared. So I remained that first draft and tried to go about living a normal life. Though I was never comfortable, happy, or even remotely at peace. So the next time things got really bad, I said, fuck this. I need to do some rewrites. Who should I become? And this crazy podcaster was that answer. I had to do this, and without compromising in any way, I've told more people to fuck off in the last 2 years than I have in my entire life. If they want to stand on the tracks yelling at the train, I'm happy to run them over without thinking twice. So, this podcast has brought me rewards of all kinds, from money to recognition. But none greater than the respect and adoration of listeners who believe in me and for whom my words mean something. That's irreplaceable. Now I understand. That rewrite was a success. But no creative work is ever perfect. It has to evolve. So as much as the podcast brought all of that light into my life, I found myself desiring more. But I had no idea how to take the story to the next draft, to find that next opportunity to change. As I looked left and right, up and down, the same barriers that had always been in place were confronting me once again. I started to feel hopeless. I thought, there has to be something I can do. But the answer escaped me. I felt this glass ceiling bearing down upon my existence. So I just kept doing the podcast and being that light for others that I'd wished would come into my life. And I knew it was selfish to want such things for myself, but I really believed there was a reason I wanted more, that the universe wanted it for me too. Yet, the road ahead seemed like a brick wall. I thought to myself, if I can't get more, then I'll just have to give more. I proceeded like that, with no promise of anything ever changing for me. I resigned myself to it, because it was the right thing to do. I thought, I'm not getting past this barrier in my life without somebody else's help. But I couldn't ask. I couldn't cry out for attention. All I could do is give more. So I did. And one day recently, while having a conversation with somebody who saw my light shining and decided to stop to look, I got news that changed my life. Afterward, I kept asking myself how to repay this person, how to offer gratitude and appreciation beyond a simple thank you. But when people help you, it's usually because they're in a position where you can't offer much value in return. And it's frustrating. You start thinking of it like a barter, as though something given must always be reciprocated with an equal reaction as a token of good faith. I thought about it the rest of the night, and there just wasn't a good answer. Because the world doesn't work like that. So I went to bed, waking up the next morning, feeling like that dark storm cloud over my head was gone. Not forever, only until the next rewrite. But in that moment, I stepped outside, and the bright sun of a wide open sky was upon me. I basked in it, in a way I hadn't in quite some time. But something was lurking beneath that feeling, something intuitive. It was then I realized the universe was talking to me, conveying a very important message, the only way it knew how. Those dark storm clouds had become a bright sunny sky, and in doing so, brought an incredible abundance of new light into my life. In fact, it was too much for one person. I found myself squinting at its power, and I said, "I hear you, motherfucker. You're bringing all of this light into my life so that I'll have even more to give other people." That's the barter. Not between you and another person, but between you and the world. Somebody became the sun for me because he could, and now I need to do that for others. That's the message. And I accept that challenge. I finally understand. It's all about what I can give. One way or another, the universe wants all of us to be the sun, to shine hope down upon others in their time of need. It's the person I've always wanted to be, but I never knew it until now. Everything I ever earn will be as a result of giving. And that, in and of itself, is the greatest gift any one of us could ever receive. There are people in this world who need to see your light, to feel its warmth. They need that hope. And the only way you can offer it is to ask yourself this: who should I become? That's what Justin DiPietro couldn't realize. He wanted to know what he could get, and was willing to sacrifice others in the process. So he received nothing. And Ayla Reynolds ended up dead, because he wasn't willing to change. Instead of using his beautiful daughter as a reason to improve his life, to write that next draft and be her son, reaping the tremendous rewards of delayed gratification, he tried to take everything. He saw a shortcut to the money and went for it. But in truth, all of the things we give and receive boil down to one idea in practice, whether a job, sex, a meal, a compliment, a bouquet of flowers, or even a laugh. And that thing is love. It's all we have to give. So be the light in someone's world. And no matter what you view in the sky, no matter how dark things become, the sun will always shine in your soul. Do that, and I promise, everyone will see it. Maybe even you.